Thank you for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. 9:40 Pacific time on Tuesdays, we check in with our friends at SailSportTalk.com. And as per usual, co-hosting the segment with me is our friend Karen Lyle. How you doing, Karen?
I'm doing fantastic, Rick. It's so good to talk to you again this week, as we do every week.
We also have a guest, very pleased to welcome David Sandy, Managing Director of the Aerospace Corporation UK, after a long career in the Royal Navy as well. David, welcome to the show, and tell us, you and Karen have collaborated on a sort of new mission, haven't you?
Yes. Well, hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks so much for having me on, Karen, Rick. I have been doing a bit of research, and I believe that you're quite the dream team when it comes to online broadcasting. So I'm very pleased to join you two legends today. And yes, Rick, you're dead right. Karen and I have been in cahoots, as we say across here, talking to members of the UK space fraternity, and more importantly, the UK government, on where we might be able to collaborate over the next, you know, 3 or 4 months.
Well, and, you know, I would like to say that, Dave, it's just such a pleasure to convert our rugby game experience into something institutional, because we met at the In-N-Out Navy and Military Club right after the Army-Navy rugby game. And, of course, you remember who won, right?
Definitely, and I believe that the U.S. have replicated that fine win this past weekend with a U.S. Navy win over the Army.
They did, and I was just wanted to ask, go back a minute, because my father was a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, and I'm a history guy, I've been fascinated by the Royal Navy, especially Lord Nelson, and I've been to the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich and seen the Cutty Sark, and then what's it like when you serve, when you think about Britannia rules the waves, and you think, when you served in there, how much of that history did you kind of feel in your bones, like centuries-long domination of the waves?
It's a great question, Rick, and it's, I've got a great answer. So, you know, I didn't have a maritime history in my family. I was the first, and I wasn't the last. My brother joined me in the Navy a few years after I joined. But there's something that resonates with being an island nation, with the significance of, you know, the maritime history that we've had and will always have. So in answer to your question, it's everywhere. It, you know, you breathe it, you feel it. It kind of follows you down Whitehall when you're in London. I've also been to Greenwich. I've also been Britannia Naval College. And, you know, the last 3 or 4 years of my professional career in the military, I was very fortunate and lucky to have a friend in Lord Nelson who stands at the top of Nelson's Column and stares out up the country, not down Whitehall, but back into the country. As a proud maritime historian, he was quite clearly, you know, the last laugh was on everybody that he was facing away from Parliament and not down towards the lawmakers who gave him so much hell during his time as Admiral Nelson over.
And yeah. King George wouldn't give him a barony. He thought it would be too expensive, I guess. I just one follow-up question. I remember when the Falklands War happened, and I was in high school, and I remember seeing the HMS Invincible steaming towards there, and the flight deck was curved up, and I thought, well, that looks ridiculous. And my dad said, that's actually smart, because when we launch our planes, they dip down below the deck and have to come back up. So I'll give you credit there with the curved-up flight deck.
Yeah, the Brits have always been reasonably good at innovation, and it's because scale has a mass on it of its own accord. And, you know, you're very fortunate in the US military and US society to benefit from, you know, having quite a lot of land and therefore being able to scale, you know, much easier than we have in the UK. The ski ramp, as we called it, and I served on a couple of aircraft carriers, the ski ramp was designed so that we wouldn't have to have very expensive jets. They were much more modest jets, which meant that they didn't go as fast on takeoff. Therefore, you needed to give them a helping hand. And the ski ramp was something that was designed for the Harrier, you know, which became a great platform for the UK and definitely earned its spurs during the Falklands War.
Well, you harry a jump jet too, and I guess someone told me that it uses up half of its fuel jumping straight up, so they try to avoid that, right?
Yeah, and if you speak to professionals, and I've got a couple of people that are that still, you know, fondly remember piloting them, the landing was a control crash, which is essentially hover above the deck until you almost run out of fuel and then try and land it without bouncing too hard.
All right, Karen, enough VTOL questions. Go ahead.
I indulged you a little bit, Rick, here, because I know that you're just such a history buff. I didn't want to break the spell.
Thank you.
But, Dave, you know, you and I know each other as friends first. We've known each other for a couple of years. I didn't know about your involvement with Aerospace Corporation UK really until this last month when I was in London for a month. But what took you from the Navy to space?
It wasn't a massive leap. Forgive the pardon the pun. You can never get away from it when you're in space. And if I say fundamental more than once, someone shoot me, please. So I was the first chief of staff in the UK Space Directorate in the Ministry of Defence, sort of pre-COVID and post. We did a big review in sort of 2018 across defence and realised that we were missing one of the domains, not, you know, deliberately. We were doing space, but we hadn't made it so overt and so openly public. It was kind of being done behind closed doors, and therefore we were missing influence with allies, partners, industry. It was a little bit difficult to be able to put a space badge on things and therefore fight across the other domains for purposeful money to be able to do big, impactful stuff. So a couple of people got together in defense and decided we needed some sort of joint unit. And I was very fortunate to be in between jobs and a bit of a problem solver, so I came into space that way. Now, that was back in sort of like, you know, 2018. Since then, I kind of hung around, did a little bit of enablement stuff. I think you know me now, you know me. It might feel like a short time, but we're very good friends, Karen, and I'm a problem solver. So space needed some problem solving. I was around. I got into it. Then I put it on the back burner and went and did some maritime stuff. And when I was leaving the Ministry of Defence, an opportunity to talk with Aerospace and help them solve some of their problems came up. So we had a good conversation, and the rest, as you say, is history.
When I think about, you're talking about the MOD, and is everything still handled in Whitehall, or is that more ceremonial now?
So it's a bit of both. It's obviously a landmark that is, you know, quite spectacular. If you've been in and around Whitehall, you can see the history, you know, and you can see the heritage of how we, you know, maintain sovereign ownership of, you know, delicate situations around the world. But the fighting arms themselves are referenced in the building, but mainly their staff are out, you know, the Navy have got a home in Portsmouth and Plymouth. The nuclear arm of our fighting services are up in Scotland and down in Plymouth. The Army are, you know, all over the place, really, and so are the RAF. They're quite dispersed. But their chiefs have got a seat on the fifth floor, one side of which, you know, faces Whitehall and is where the military staff sit. The other side faces away from Whitehall is where the politicians sit. So it's run as a Secretary of Defence, you know, a Secretariat of Defence. And then the fighting arms, Army, Navy, Air Force, and nice space.
Well, and really, the square, the historic square mile, too, which is part of the domain that we occupy when we're over there in London, you and I, with the livery companies, 114 livery companies and all of their guild halls, and actually each one that supports some branch of the military and used to be the military, because they all had their own military units that defended the city of London back 900 years ago and so forth. Why did you say to me when we were sitting in the Goat Brasserie in the In-N-Out Club that we needed a space livery when I was talking about the stationer's company and the livery that I was in? Because that was kind of formative for us. That was the pivotal point where we made a change.
Yeah, so we were talking about the sea, the sky. We were talking about them as anchors, how when you look at them, they feel endless, but they also order some thinking. And, you know, I suppose for centuries, they've been navigational guides, And then we got talking about technology, and we spoke about there's a true sense of, vastness in what drives modern professions. We talked a little bit about space operations and AI and digital innovation. And then we realized that, when we talk like this naturally, some people understand it and some people don't. But we very quickly settled on the fact that these new professions don't seem to be championed anywhere. We can see that they sort of overlap in other livery areas and other organizations, but they don't have their own identity. And that was when you and I started talking about how do we place symbolism on some of these new complex digital professions that are going to endure, they're the next iteration of big professions that will endure for the next, 200, 300, 500 years.
Karen, we have time for one more question. Go ahead, because I hogged earlier.
It's okay. So I'm gonna tell you something, Rick. You don't know this about me because we don't have a space livery yet to define my job, but I actually do design and invent governance systems for AI and so forth that go into that are applied to space, which is why Dave and I were talking about this. And Dave, we sent a document. I sent a document to you that was starting from calligraphy in San Francisco when I got back from London. It went under the bay, the same route that Rick takes when he goes to work to the sports byline, and then went by plane to you. And you have it now, this document, which is the instrument of the founding council for the Space and Oceans Unified Sustainability and Systems Ad Hoc Council. How does it feel to have that little document in your hand that's just about to institute something?
It's very historic, and thank you for your hard work and getting it across to us. So there's an action on us now to form our little ad hoc council of half a dozen, a dozen people, and figure out what we do, because this is too important. It's so much bigger than you and I, and we really do need to, merge the sea, the sky, the digital environment that we live in, and the new professions, because I think people will now begin to trust us as the sponsors of this technology and help guide everybody to what, would have been an unseen future, but now I think we're defining it day by day.
It's David Sandy, Managing Director of the Aerospace Corporation UK Limited. You can go to aerospace.org for more information. David, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks, Karen.
Delight to see you on the air.
All right, Karen, we'll catch up next week.
We will do. Thanks, Rick.
All
Always
right.
good to talk to you.
All right, always. Let's take a quick break, and we will come on back on Sports Byline.